Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Last Stop Waterfowl Outdoors. On this week's show, we have a jam-packed episode, so we hope you enjoy it. So sit back, relax, grab a cold beverage, and let's talk everything there is to know in Louisiana outdoors. Guys, you hear us talk about it all the time. Our buddy Jay Thomas over at Blind Grass Camouflage Systems offers hunters and outdoorsmen the most realistic, durable, and versatile camouflage materials available on the market today. Let me ask you something. Are you tired of constantly having to rebrush your blinds every year or the smell of rotting grass in your blind? How about grass that pokes and cuts you through grass mats that have no depth in color and does not last an entire season? Well, the answer to that is probably yes, you've experienced that same scenario. And Blind Grass's patented synthetic blind grass will not rot, mildew, and is 100% waterproof. And it's available in mats or bundles, and it comes in natural gas color blends or is paintable to match your unique surroundings. Folks, do yourself a favor. If you're looking to camouflage your boat blind, kayak, permanent blind, or anything else that you're looking to blend in with your surroundings, check out our friends at Blind Grass Camouflage Systems. You can visit them on the web at blindgrass.com. This episode of Last Stop Waterfowl Outdoors Podcast is also brought to you by SRD20 Boat Products. It shouldn't be hard work. SRD20 products use advanced nanotechnologies in its formulations, explicitly designed for boat maintenance. From boat waxes for detailing to waterless wash and wax products, SRD20 has boat care products that keep your boat protected from the elements and looking brand new. Visit them online at www.srd20.com and enter promo code LASTSTOP for 20% off all SRD20 products today. Hey, what is going on, everybody? Welcome to a new episode of Last Stop Waterfowl Outdoors Podcast. I'm your host, Jacob Robery, and guys, this is episode 1 of season 7. We are kicking things off here as we are now in January of 2024. And with that being said, we are now just a couple of weeks away from duck season, officially closing up for the 2023-2024 waterfowl season here in Louisiana, as well as many areas across the flyway. And I know that at this point, you're either done hung it up by now, probably, or you are exhausted. Or if you're like many of us, you're probably still kind of ready to go. Keep it going. Keep the momentum rolling if you're having a good one. If you're not having a good one, which has kind of been our story this second half of the season, I'm still ready to go, to be honest with you. So it's kind of odd. As slow as it's been, I still have the fire and the want to go out there right now and try to finish the season strong. And I'm sure many of you are probably like that as well, because let's just be honest, you don't get a whole lot of time. Even though this season has felt like it's one of the longest seasons I've ever hunted. I don't know what it is about this season, but it just seems like it has dragged on, but I'm not complaining about it. It just seems like it's been a very, very long season. So, a lot has still been going on. A lot of us are still out there. We're after it. We kind of been holding out for some cold weather, and we're trying to finish the season strong. So I know that's the case with us. That's probably the case with you. If you're listening to this podcast right now, you're probably one of those diehards that is still out there going at it strong right now. So like I mentioned, 2 weeks until we wrap it up officially here for the 2023-2024 season. And really, it's been a tale of two seasons, guys. I mean, it has been a tale of two seasons. And I've told several people that. They say, hey, man, how's it going? How's your season going? How was it? And I tell people that exact quote. I say it's been a tale of two seasons, because that's exactly what it was for us and for a lot of people that we have talked to, a lot of friends that we have talked to across the flyways, all across the United States hunting this season. It has been a tale of two seasons. And what I mean by that is, you know, for us, we started out the season, the first half of the season, really strong. We had a lot of birds here whenever the season opened up in November, mid to late November. And then we carried that momentum into early December, you know. And that was kind of the story. We were killing a lot of birds. We had a lot of puddle ducks down here. We had a lot of teal that had showed up early on. And we were having a lot of success, our group specifically. And we were killing limits of birds. And then the split closed for the areas that we were hunting. And it seems like once it reopened, it just kind of went downhill from there. And it went downhill quickly. So it has been a rough go this second half of the season, to say the least. And, I mean, it's gotten so bad, guys, that we are struggling just to get a couple of birds on most hunts that we go on. Now, I will say this, and you know, some of that is my fault with my group, or I say my group. It's pretty much been me and Jackson hunting most of the season, with the exception of a couple of buddies of ours we've been on some hunts with and that we've hunted with across the state of Louisiana. But for the most part, you know, a lot of times when you see us on the videos that we put out there, it's me and Jackson a lot of times, or me and Jackson and maybe one other friend of ours that comes along, or maybe it's one of his friends. So, you know, me and him have been going hard at it, especially the second half of the season. I've been having him with me quite a bit because I've been trying to get him caught up, because as tough as I say the second half of the season's been, it's been an even more miserable season for him. And with the reason being is because the first half of the season this year, he had a lot of obligations that he was trying to take care of. So when the hunting was good for us, and he wasn't able to come on a lot of the hunts that we were going on, me and a couple of my buddies that I hunt with, my close friends, that we were having a lot of success on. So he was either in school because it was during the week that we were making some of those hunts, or he had obligations that he had to get taken care of on the weekends. So he had some driver's ed stuff this year he had to take care of. He had some religious stuff that he was taking care of for his religious studies through school. Just obligations that had his age. He's 15, you know, 14, going on 15 years old. He's a freshman in high school. Got a lot of stuff going on. So he wasn't able to really capitalize on some of those hunts with us that we had a lot of success on early in the season. So I kind of have been grinding to get him a good hunt or two, you know, before we wrap things up. And it's been tough. It's got to the point where he's real frustrated. He's kind of been wanting to stop waterfowl, stop duck hunting for the season, kind of hang it up, lick his wounds, take his losses, and kind of do some deer hunting, which is perfectly fine with me. I'm totally okay with that for him. But then I get ready to go, and it gets him fired up, and he wants to go. Excuse me. So, you know, we're trying to get him on a good hunt before we wrap up the end of the season, and as well as, to be honest, as well as myself right now, we just want to have some good successful hunts to kind of have you know, an end to the season, and some, you know, it's been tough. So that's the situation it's in. But what I said when I stated that, you know, some of that was my fault is the areas that we've been hunting over the last couple of weeks, we've been kind of trying to force those areas because we have a camp, we have a lease that we have a camp at, not a hunting lease, but a camp lease. And we've been going to our camp. We know there's not a ton of birds that's been in the area, you know, in that particular area, but we've been trying to spend a little bit of time there so we can enjoy our camp lease this year. And in the meantime, maybe kill a couple of ducks and, you know, everybody be happy, get your money's worth out of the camp lease, that type of stuff, you know. So the birds that we were on in the first half of the season really have kind of dried up, and that's kind of been the story, you know, season after season. You know, a lot of guys talk about extending the seasons to go a little bit later because it seems like every year once the seasons close up, you see birds when you go out fishing. Maybe you start to do some springtime fishing. Maybe you're just getting out there to the camp and you're around the water. You see some birds showing up, lots of ducks. And a lot, you know, back in the day, I used to feel the same. I'd say, man, we need to push the season back. We need to push the season back because the birds are showing up later and later every year. Well, you know, if you go back and you look at the numbers, and me and a couple of close hunting friends of mine have actually looked into this some, and we've done a lot of research on this, on some of our hunts from the past years. And if you look at it, you know, from year to year, our best days of hunting here in Louisiana, especially South Louisiana, has always been, for the most part, when the season opens up in mid to late November and into early December, which mimics our success that we had this year at those times. So I did a little bit of research, and I listened to a lot of other podcasts, and you know, a lot of times on some of these podcasts, they have biologists that come on as guests and they talk about it. And one caught my interest recently, and I can't recall what the name of the podcast was, or I would give them a shout out, but I was listening to a podcast and they had a biologist on there talking about the numbers and the late season numbers of ducks showing up, that people are saying, hey, after the season closes, we see lots of ducks. We need to push the seasons back. So people are, you know, asking to maybe push seasons back further and further. Well, this particular biologist was talking about how the birds begin to pair up, obviously, towards the end of the season, which right now we have 2 weeks left in the season. You have birds that are going to be pairing up and ready to make the migration back up north for the springtime. And they were talking about how a female chooses the male partner and courts these males at this time of the season right now in order to eventually choose a mating partner and, you know, be able to hopefully make the journey back up north to the breeding grounds. And they were talking about everything that went into that courting of picking out the male. So if you've ever seen, you know, ducks in the mating process, especially when they're trying to pair up, especially whenever they get paired up and they starting to have, you know, ducklings and stuff like that, it can be a strenuous process on a female, on a hen. So they said, you know, in this podcast that it takes several weeks for the female or the hen to be able to pick out the male that she wants to pair up with. And then once that male is picked up then the courting process, you know, begins, the mating process begins. And, you know, hopefully by the time that's all done, she is well rested. They can make a journey up north, you know, lots of food. They've been eating down south, hopefully, you know, in their journey that they've made down south. And she's healthy to make a good return back to the breeding grounds. That's just the cliff notes of it, basically, how it works out. But he talked about if the seasons were to be pushed back, you know, and what the effects are, that process that takes several weeks to pick out a male partner, then, you know, the mating process, and then they go into a feeding period before they return, you know, up north. That if the season were to be pushed back, as an example, and you have that drake and that hen that are paired together, and you kill, for example, you kill or harvest that drake and break that pair up, then that process for that hen has to start all over. That cycle has to start all over once again. So from the courting process to the mating process to the loading up on food again, if they make that journey back before she's healthy enough, then it puts more stress on the hen. It can affect the number of ducklings that she has once she returns to the breeding grounds, and it can really or greatly affect the breeding process as a whole and the number of hatchlings that we have in a particular season. So it was really interesting whenever I was listening to that whole explanation of how it works. So they said that's a big part of why we cannot allow the seasons to be continuously pushed back or to keep going further back and going later into the year, because they're pairing up, because they're going through that courting process and that mating process, and then trying to make that return trip back up to the breeding grounds. So if you think about it like that, and you know the data, and you see the results of what stress that can cause and how it can affect the ultimate grand picture of the breeding for a particular year and a cycle, then you will quickly understand, guys, that pushing the season back is probably not the best idea or the best thing to do from a legislative standpoint. So it kind of made, and really, to be honest with y'all, it opened up my eyes because I never really thought of it that way. But when you look at what goes into that breeding process, pairing up, courting, you know, all that type of stuff, there is a lot of stress that is put on a hen or a female duck in the mating process and then the return journey back up to those nesting grounds. So that's really why they haven't passed any kind of legislative in quite some time to extend the seasons or push them back a little bit further. And it makes a lot of sense whenever you look into that data. From what he was saying, the biologist that was on that particular podcast, he was talking about at one time the seasons were closing even earlier than they do now. But a lot of pressure was put on Ducks Unlimited, a lot of pressure was put on Delta Waterfowl, and on governments to push the seasons back later than they were. And a lot of that pressure was coming from down south in the southern states because it took longer for the birds to get down to us here down south. And a lot of the hunters down here were pushing for those seasons to be pushed back. So, like, very similar to what you hear people talking about now. Well, they were able to get that stuff, that legislation passed to where they pushed back the seasons to where they close now. Most of them are going to be closing at the end of January. And pretty much that's been adopted just about everywhere. And if I'm not mistaken, he said the first state that was able to extend those seasons was Louisiana. And then once Louisiana did, it was either Louisiana or Mississippi. I don't want to be incorrect on that. It was one of the two states. It was either Louisiana or Mississippi. And once the first state got it adopted, then the other state ended up adopting it about a year or two later and extended their season because they felt it wasn't fair that the bordering state had their season pushed back and that they wanted to do the same as well. And then it became adopted by both states. So really it was a push for the hunters down south, us down here, to extend the seasons a little bit later into the year. Because previously it wasn't that way. We didn't go as long as that. And I don't quite remember that. Some of you who listened to the show, you may remember that whenever the seasons were a little bit earlier. I do remember when the limits and stuff were three at one point. And then at one point we had a point system that we were required to follow in order for your bag limits and stuff like that. I do remember that coming up through the years and as a child hunter with my dad, that type of stuff. But I don't remember it necessarily finishing earlier in the years. To me, for some reason, it seems like it's always pretty much been end of January. So I'm not exactly sure when that was adopted, but that was the story and the explanation that he provided into how we got to where we are now, where the seasons close at the end of January. So, you know, pushing it back may not be the ultimate answer. I know we see a lot more ducks, or at least it seems, it appears, that we see a lot more ducks once the season closes. And when you think about it, you know, he made a very good point. He said, hey, it's a very simple point, explanation to that. He says, when you eliminate the hunting pressure in the areas that you've been frequenting throughout the season, you will see more ducks loafing around. You'll see more ducks. It'll seem like more ducks are congregated. And in theory, you think that there's more ducks that are showing up. But in reality, a lot of those ducks have been here the whole time. They've just been in areas where they're not getting pressure. That was the explanation that was given by this particular biologist on the podcast. And that does make some sense. I would think that probably is true somewhat. I'm not 100% sure that's the explanation or the answer for all of it. I think maybe some of those ducks do arrive a little later than others. But, you know, that may be a very good point he made, that a lot of those ducks that have been getting pressured, they're finding those sanctuaries that where they aren't getting a ton of hunting pressure. They're finding those game preserves, you know, where they're not getting pressured, or just general areas that are not getting pressured, like your local WMAs and your public, you know, land, state land, and your hunting clubs, you know. So I can see that definitely be playing into the scenario. And it does make some sense. So, but I thought that was really interesting. When he explained that and the whole mating process, there's a lot that goes into it that us as waterfowl and duck hunters, we don't tend to think about. But most duck hunters and most waterfowl hunters are in some way or another, whether they indirectly or directly are associated, we're conservationists in some aspects, you know. I know I am. I look at myself as a waterfowl hunter, but I also look at myself as a conservationist as well. Yes, of course, I want to kill ducks, and I want to be able to have ducks, you know, whenever I go out every year and I buy a hunting license and I go waterfowl hunting. But I also have sons coming up. I also want to see one day my grandkids be able to hunt ducks like I've hunted growing up with my father and with my grandfather. And the only way we can do that for future generations is to be conservationists in some way. And when you're young and you start out hunting and you get out there on your own, you don't really think about things like that. But as you get a little bit older and you progress in your hunting career, and you go through different stages, which I had just talked about that on the last podcast, about how you go through different phases as a waterfowl hunter in your career. Then as you get older, you want to see that conservation aspect of it be amplified. You want to see, you know, you become more of a conservationist yourself in the way you hunt, in the way you go about doing things, because you want to have ducks, you know, in the coming generations. You want to be able to, you know, look, I like myself, without getting too fancy and twisted on my words, but when I look at myself at 44 years old right now, well, hell, I look at myself, as long as God's willing and I'm physically able to, then I got at least another 20 years to 25 years, hopefully, of waterfowl hunting in my career, in my lifetime, you know, and hopefully older than that. But when I look at 15, 20, 25 years down the road, and we every year talking about how there's less and less waterfowl and it's not what it used to be, then what's it going to be then? You know, and that's what I think about now as an older hunter, a little bit older hunter, you know, that's been in the field doing this for years and years and years. So, you know, I had a little guy today that I was talking to, a young guy, he's in high school, you know, we were talking about how the hunt's been and all this and that, and he looked at me and he says, do you believe in baiting? And I looked at him and I kind of tilted my head at him and I said, wait, what you mean? And he says, I said, baiting for ducks? And he said, yes, sir. He says, because I hear guys bait for ducks, and that's some of the guys that are having success. And I told him, I said, yeah, that probably is a part of it, you know, and yes, there are people that do that, I'm sure. But I said, I'm not one of them. You know, I don't believe in that. I said, it's not something that I think is good for the future of the sport. I said, and that would be something that I would be strongly against, you know. I said, but yes, the reality is that people probably do that. I said, but I can promise you it is not worth it from a personal standpoint, from legal standpoint of it, if you were to get caught or busted. I said, and it's also not worth it from a conservationist standpoint if you want to have ducks continue to be able to kill ducks once you get a little bit older and you have kids. And that's how I kind of explained it to this young man that asked me that today. And look, this young man is not doing this, I don't believe. That's not something he's personally doing. But he's probably hearing chatter. He's hearing his friends talk about, oh, these guys are killing them because they probably baiting and all this stuff that you hear. You know, we all hear it. We got social media. You hear it on social media. You hear it by word of mouth at the boat launches, all that type of stuff. And there are situations where I've ran across it on public land where I know that people had frequented an area and baited an area at some point in time that I came across on public land, because you find evidence from time to time. You find sacks of corn, you know, old sacks of corn, stuff like that. And, you know, I've never come across anybody that I've ran into that was actually doing it at the time where I've caught them in the act of doing it. But I know it goes on, and I know it happens whether they have private land or public land. It probably happens on both. You know, you'd be kind of, you know, oblivious to the facts or oblivious to the idea that it doesn't happen. And that's not, you know, that's just not the real world, you know. So But I answered him with as honest as an answer as I can, and I tried to put a little bit of fear in him. I told him, I said, look, man, you know, if you were to do that, I said, it's not worth it. You know, you get caught, you go in front of a federal judge. I said, it's a federal offense. You know, not only are you going to lose your hunting license, your firearms, you're going to get fined. You have possible prison time. I mean, there's a lot of things. I kind of tried to be, you know, to be upfront with y'all. I tried to kind of put the fear of God in him, you know, because I don't know if, you know, him learning, if this is something he's thinking, well, maybe I should do this, you know, because, you know, it'll benefit me, it'll help me. And he may not be looking at the long-term picture, you know. And like I said, guys, I am not accusing this guy of doing that because I don't think he is at all. I think it was an honest question to see what I would, you know, as an older duck hunter or waterfowler, what I was going to say and how I was going to answer it. But I answered him as honest as I could because I am not a believer in that. I told him, I said, I abide by the laws as best as I can. You know, if I were to get a ticket for something, it's not going to be because it was done intentionally, you know. But when it comes to baiting, it comes to that type of stuff, I said, that's something that's a very simple answer for me and for any individual or hunter, in my opinion. You either choose to do the right thing or you choose to do the wrong thing. And that's a very simple decision for most of us. So, you know, stuff like that, practices like that, that's all part of being a conservationist or not being a conservationist. You know, and a lot of times I find that when you begin your career in waterfowl hunting and duck hunting, you start out, you know, you're faced with some of those questions, I guess. You know, like this young man was. I don't know if he's considering doing it or it's just something that he was asking about just to make conversation. But I'm sure that crosses some people's minds at some point because people do it, you know. So, but anyway, I found that very interesting whenever he asked me that today. And, you know, he's like anybody else. He's like, I was at that age when he got hooked on duck hunting and it's just all he thinks about now. And that's a great thing. But, you know, you want to teach him right. I don't know what his, you know, if he has a dad or a granddad or somebody taking him out there, showing him the right thing, how to do things. But, you know, by him asking a question like that, I want to be able to educate him and lead him in the right direction, or I'm not doing my job to be a conservationist for our sport, for our future. So, you know, if you get somebody like that, guys, that's asking questions like that, try to lead them in the right direction. You know, don't laugh at them, don't mock them, don't ridicule them, because there are serious questions out there that people are asking that they're maybe thinking about doing some, or they may be wondering what goes into that. And it could alter their life ultimately and change their life if the wrong decision's made. Yeah, you know, and yes, it is their choice at some point, but they got to be taught the right way as well, you know. So hopefully, you know, we're all doing the right thing and trying to help everybody, teach them the right way. And I think a lot of times in our sport, we have a lot of good people that mean well. And we also have a lot of good people that like to joke around. You know, we talked about that in the last podcast as well. We have a lot of people that like to joke around, and sometimes we do it in a harsh manner. But we just got to take each individual, you know, as they come and each question as they come. So that's my point I'm trying to make. But yeah, you know, with it being as tough as it's been this year, guys, like I mentioned, we're just trying to finish up the season strong. And you know, I posted a question on one of our social media pages lately. And I was kind of interested to know, because as waterfowl hunters, we have a lot of superstitions. We have a lot of do's and don'ts when it comes to certain things. And I posted a question, and I'll read the question to you guys, and then we'll kind of discuss it. I'd love to get your opinions. I posted this question on social media, and I asked for some opinions, and I'm going to read a couple of them that I got responses back and kind of see what you guys think as well as my response to it. But the question that I asked is, as a group of waterfowl hunters, as a duck hunter, do you believe in a hierarchy of duck species, and why or why not? So, to put it in simple terms, guys, as waterfowl hunters, do you believe that certain ducks are better than other ducks, certain species, certain sex, You know, are drakes better than the hens? Are hens better than the drakes? Are mallards higher up in your hierarchy than, say, a diver duck is? And if so, why or why not? I was interested to know that because I know for me, I'll start out kind of giving you guys the take on my stuff is I think everybody ultimately as a duck hunter, you get into duck hunting, the mallard drake is probably the most sought after duck in the duck species. So to answer my own question, I would say that yes, I believe there, for most people, there is a hierarchy with the mallard drake being the king of the hierarchy on the duck list. But for me personally, I'm not going to say that a drake, mallard drake isn't, which kind of got me wondering now, asking myself that question. You know, my favorite duck personally is the American Wigeon. That's my favorite duck. When you get a drake American Wigeon and you get to work a group of Wigeon and how vocal they are, all that type of stuff, I just love it. That's one of my favorite ducks. That's probably the king of my hierarchy that I rate ducks on. I like the American Wigeon personally. But I'm not going to lie, a mallard drake, especially nowadays, because we don't get many of them anymore. Yeah, there's nothing more beautiful than showing a strap of greenheads, mallard drakes, you know, and having that on a strap and being able to harvest that and fill a limit of mallard drakes. So I think that the mallard drake obviously is at the top of most people's list when it comes to waterfowl species. Especially in the United States, you know, I think that for the most part, that's the top of the list in most people's opinion, or at least it's been, you know, advertised to be the king of all the ducks in the United States, you know, because it's when people make logos, duck logos, or they put stuff on clothing, all that type of stuff, most of the time you're going to see a mallard drake on there, you know, so that's just what everybody associates with duck hunting for the most part. But does it, when it comes to species, is it like, you know, you break puddle ducks down compared to diver ducks, you know, that type of stuff, or like wood ducks is a good example, because wood ducks, I got friends through the years that would tell me, man, I ain't getting up to get out of bed to go kill three wood ducks. That's just wood ducks you kill them. Or I'd shoot them over a picture after a hunt with some wood ducks and they'd say, what else did you kill? And I'd say, nothing. I killed wood ducks. Well, that's all you killed was woodies? And it's almost like it was a, man, what you doing? Just hunting woodies, you know? So obviously those friends had a hierarchy and wood ducks wasn't very much on the top of their list, you know? So it gets to be kind of interesting when you talk to people and get their opinions on that. But I thought it'd be an awesome question to ask because it's definitely a conversation piece, you know, that sparks a conversation. So I'm going to read a couple of comments, from some people that answered and replied to the couple of the responses that we got from the question that I posted on social media. So once again, I'll read that question that was posted. It says, as a duck owner, do you believe in a hierarchy of duck species? And if so, why or why not? And we had a response from our buddies over at Full Plume. Those of you who follow social media, you're on social media, you guys are going to be probably familiar with Full Plume. You got Jacob and Megan, the two owners of Full Plume. They have an awesome company that they go out. They are, I always, when I had them on the podcast last year, last season, I told them, I said, you guys are the American pickers for the duck hunters, for duck hunters out there. And that's what they are, you know. So if you're not familiar with Full Plume, I highly advise you to go check them out. Jacob and Megan are some great people. And they did a great thing this year. They started the Full Plume Co-op, which is a group of hunters that come together, get together, and they help each other out to have successful hunts and, you know, to be able to help each other out with equipment. Maybe one guy has a four-wheeler that he can contribute to the group. Another guy might have a piece of property that they can hunt, or maybe, you know, whatever. It could be a boat, whatever it could be. It's a group of hunters that come together. They're kind of, I don't want to say interviewed, but they're filtered to make sure it's a good group of people that come together before they all you know, accepted into the group, and they help each other out throughout the season, and be able to have success and help each other out. That's a great thing, in my opinion. So Full Plume responded back. They said, no such thing as a trash duck, but I'm not going to shoot something I will not eat. And that's a great point, you know. So trash duck, that's something that you hear that term thrown out there a lot. And what is a trash duck to one guy may not be a trash duck to the next hunter, you know, or a hunter in a different region, you know. And a great example of that down here in Louisiana is the Dogri, or the greater sculp, lesser sculp. We refer to them as Dogri down here in Louisiana. And you hear a lot of controversy or comments over Dogris. So, you know, just to give you, paint a picture for you, if you are below I-10, Interstate 10 here in Louisiana, then you're probably accustomed and your bag limits are probably oftentimes filled with Dogri mixed into your bag limit, you know, because they're real common down here in the marshes. Whether it's a freshwater marsh or saltwater marsh, it's a very common bird that's become even more part of a bag limit or part of the bag limits through the last decades, because there's so many of them now down here that come in the winter here in Louisiana. So the Dogri, there's guys that I will hunt with. Jackson's a great example. My son Jackson, he hates Dogri. He has it built up into his mind that he hates the Dogri duck now when it comes to hunting. He won't even want to go hunt if that's all we're going to kill. Because I say, why? You know, I asked him, I said, why? He says, they're ugly. He says, they have drab colors. You know, there's nothing pretty about them, in my opinion. Blah, 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 this and that. Yeah, he has all these, you know, these shallow answers, basically, that he has built up into his mind that it's not a duck worth even pursuing and going out there and kill. Now, what I tell him is, I say, you're just spoiled, because when I was coming up at his age, I would have taken anything I could get, and I still, for the most part, will take just about anything I can get. Being a public land hunter, I take what comes to me, you know? So I'm not going to turn down a diver hunt when I could go out there and it's a lot of fun, fast-paced action. I'm not going to turn down a diver hunt just because I think I'm, you know, I think that there's better species to kill out there, you know? Because it's, you guys know how tough it can be. You know, whenever you say six ducks for a limit, we all have a six duck bag limit for the most part across the flyways. When you look at that, it seems in reality like, or I mean, not in reality, let me say that. It seems in theory as though six ducks is no big deal, right? Six is no big deal. You should be able to go out on a hunt, kill six birds, no problem. When in reality, we all know how hard it can be to get that six sometimes and fill a bag limit. Because we all go out there and we don't have limits every hunt, that's for sure, you know? So we know how tough that can be. And I'm sure not going to be so picky that I'm going to say, well, I'm not going to hunt this species because they're not equivalent to this species, you know? Just as an example. But there's a lot of hunters that are like that, and that's okay. That's perfectly fine. I'm just not of that opinion. But what Full Plume responded here is, you know, there's no such thing as a trash duck. I feel that way as well. That's how I feel about it, what I've just told you guys in my opinion. But I'm not, and they went on to say, I'm not going to shoot something I won't eat. And I'm the same way with that. So I totally agree with what they're saying right here in their response. Because if it's a duck, like if it's a merganser, that's the first one, the thing that comes to mind. A hooded merganser. We got tons of them this season. Down here, we tend to get a lot of them here in Louisiana. We'll let hooded mergansers land in decoys and stay there the whole damn hunt. I'm not going to shoot a hooded merganser purposely because it's not a bird that I'm going to eat. You know, another species that I kind of stray away from now, for the most part, is bufflehead. Bufflehead is a beautiful bird. I know they eat just fine. And some days I may shoot them. I may choose to shoot them some days. But if we have lots of birds out there and we could, you know, have other species that we'll shoot, then I'll shoot them. I'll shoot other species. I'll pass on the bufflehead. And my reason being is that they're just a little bit tougher bird to clean. You know, it's a little bit more difficult to clean that type of species of bird than it is some of the others. But that doesn't mean that I have a hatred for them or that I think that they're not good to eat, none of that type of stuff. So it's just a preference of mine, I guess you could say, in that situation. But if I'm not going to eat a certain bird, which there's not many bird species I won't eat that makes its way down here to Louisiana, then I agree, I won't shoot it. I'm not just going to shoot the bird just to shoot it and dispose of it, throw it away, that's for sure. You know, so I thought that's a good response from the guys over at Full Plume, and it's a response that I agree with a lot, you know, kind of with my own personal values on that. Another response we got from Lone Star Cajun was that generally I prefer puddle ducks for no specific reason, he said. So, yeah, so Lone Star Cajun, what he's saying is he just has a preference for puddle ducks, you know. So in his hierarchy of waterfowl, he's looking for mallards, he's looking for gadwall, he's looking for widgeon, he's looking for spoonbills. All your puddle ducks that make up your puddle duck category, that's what he prefers to hunt. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's probably tons of you listening to the podcast right now that agree with him on that, you know? And that's perfectly fine. You know, what a beautiful hunt. If you have the luxury of being able to harvest all puddle ducks, then, yeah, that's a lot of fun. I'm not even going to lie to you. That's a lot of fun because that makes up a lot of great species of ducks that are beautiful waterfowl, in my opinion. But in my opinion, I also think, saying that, I also think almost all waterfowl are beautiful. You know, I really do. To me, each species of waterfowl has some characteristic about it that makes it unique and makes it special. And I think a lot of times that makes that species beautiful, you know. But I totally get what he's saying here, that, hey, for me personally, I'd rather shoot puddle ducks. And I can't say I disagree with him on that. Can't say I blame him for that. That's who wouldn't want to go out there and shoot mallards and you know, all the puddle duck species on your hunts that you go on, you know? So, very honest answer. And he went on to say, I have no specific reason for that. That's just what he likes. And that's fine. That's perfectly fine. Another comment that came in. This is Picks by a Brit. Username Picks by a Brit. No, but I like some more. He says, no, but I like some more than others. Although the less tasty ones do rank lower. So yeah, makes a lot of sense. You know, so he prefers some of the other species, probably your puddle duck species, but he's not calling out any specific species in his hierarchy. He's just saying, hey, I like some of the ones that taste better, you know, and he obviously he has an opinion on which duck species taste better. So he does have a hierarchy, obviously, but he's not naming any specific species. And that's hey, that makes sense, you know. I think there's no wrong answer to this question. It's just it's interesting to know how people look at it from their perspective, and that's why I thought it was an interesting question. So, yeah, if he's experienced a certain duck that he's eaten before that was harvested and he thought it had a bad taste or he had a bad experience, then, yeah, he's probably not going to want that at the top of his hierarchy. And I think, honestly, when it comes to table fare, ducks being table fare, a lot of times it's how it's prepared, how that species is prepared. And I always laugh and I joke. I tell people all the time, I say, hey, man, you know, if you're from Louisiana, chances are you know how to cook, and we can make a turd taste good, you know, with the way we cook down here. And there's other areas of the United States I know that are known for certain meals and preparation on how they prepare their meals and have stuff that are signature dishes. But down here in Louisiana, Cajuns and Coonasses can pretty much cook just about anything and make it taste good, you know. So there's not many duck species, personally, that I've tried that I can't make taste pretty damn good, you know? And there's some people that don't have a taste for duck, and I get that, you know? I'm like that with certain wild game, you know? There's certain wild game that I don't have as much of a particular favor for over other, you know, species of wild game. So, yeah, I get it. If you have a bad experience, you've eaten a certain species of duck, and it's not your favorite, then obviously you're going to have a hierarchy for other species, you know? So that's another great point. That's a point that you can't disagree with on that, you know? And then my last one that I'll read to you guys, this one is from Team the Waterfowl. Username, Team Waterfowl. They're also on social media. Common Morganzas or the king of the ducks. Anyone who doesn't believe that is crazy. So I'm going to pause there for a second. And I did that intentionally because Team Waterfowl, I'm assuming and I'm hoping. And I consider myself to be a pretty good common sense guy. I'm assuming Team Waterfowl, you guys can agree with me probably, that Team Waterfowl is making a joke on that. So now I will say this. A common merganza. I have never eaten a common merganza in my waterfowl hunting career. I've never eaten one as table fare before. So I have no expertise, no opinion. I cannot tell you whether or not a common merganza is a good bird for table fare. But if it tastes anything like a hooded merganza, which I've only eaten once, maybe twice in my 44 years of being on this earth, then I could tell you that a common merganza is not good table fare. And it is not the hierarchy of the duck species. So I'm assuming Team Waterfowl is making a joke right here. And I'm sure 99.9% positive that's the situation on that comment. But we appreciate your comment, Team Waterfowl. And I literally laughed out loud when I read it because I was like, yep, somebody's going to. I was waiting on it. I'll be honest with you. I was waiting on the Morganza comment. I knew somebody was going to say something about that or the pool dew or the coot, something like that. And, hey, look, don't knock pool dew or coots, you know, like we call them the rails, you know, down because – down here in Louisiana, that's been a delicacy for generations down here. The pool dew or the American coot, you know, that type of stuff. And I promise you, that is good table fare. And if you haven't tried it before, for those of you guys, our friends who are in the other portions of the flyways, maybe you're in the northern areas of the United States, the upper portions of the flyways, then trust me, next time you're out there, kill you a couple of coots when they're in your spread and try cooking them. And it is it's really good table fare. Now, there's different ways to do it. The gizzards are something down here in Louisiana, we're known for our gumbos. The gizzards in a gumbo give it a really good rich flavor, very good taste. But there's also other ways to cook them, just like you would much of your other waterfowl. And I can promise you that you'd be surprised by the taste of coots and stuff like that. So it's the Gallinu is something that I'll tell y'all a quick story on that. A couple of years ago, you know, at our camp that we hunt, we're in the swamp. And me and Jackson, you know, we've been hunting these timber holes second half of the season for years, you know. And we always get a lot of Gallinu in those areas. They like those. That kind of cut grass, that reed grass, because they'll come down here in the swamps. And when you have the swamp filled with that cut grass, they love to get up in there, and it's a great nesting area for them during the wintertime. Keeps them warm. It keeps them away from a lot of predators. You know, they can build their nest. They can start their mating process, you know, when they migrate down here. And I had talked to this older guy at the launch one day, and he came out with some of them. And he's like, man. He's like, y'all ever eat these? And I was like, no, I never have. I never ate a gallon. I said, I have eaten coot before, and they look a lot like a coot. He says, yeah, but it's not a coot. He says, it's not like a coot. He says, it's actually in the rail family. And he said, it's a different type of species, different bird, different taste, different flavor. And I said, really? He says, yeah. He says, I'm telling you. He says, it is very, very good. He says, they have these big leg quarters on them. He said, almost like big chicken legs. He said, and he says it's a white meat, he says, and it's very, very good. You can cook it in a stew. He says there's different ways you can do it, he says, but I like to cook it in a stew. So I told Jackson, I said, you know what? I said, as many as we see, we're going to go ahead and we're going to harvest a couple of those. We're going to shoot a few of those. I said, I got to see this for myself. I want to clean them and see what they look like. So sure enough, we went on a hunt about a week or two later. And boy, they were out that day that we were on. And I told Jackson, I said, hey, I said, look, man, they got a bunch of them out. I said, let's shoot about three or four of them. I said, then we're gonna try to clean them in the camp with the ducks. I said, we're gonna cook them. We're gonna cook them up. See how they are. So he says, all right. He kind of got fired up about it, you know. So I let him shoot a couple of them. I think I shot one or two of them. And we put them on the strap with our ducks that day. Went back to the camp. And when I started plucking them, I realized very quickly they were kind of like if you ever plucked a bufflehead, like we talked about a while ago, a little bit tougher pluck to them, kind of like the feathers stick to the skin a little bit more, you know, than a regular duck, a puddle duck or a diver. And it's just a little bit different type of pluck. But anyway, we got that done. And we went ahead and we started processing them. And sure enough, the meat was a white meat. Like a very, like almost like a chicken breast or a chicken leg, you know, chicken meat. And I looked at Jackson, I was just shocked. I was like, man, really? I was like, I didn't expect that. I thought, you know, if he wouldn't have told me that this man we had ran into, I would have thought it would have been a darker meat, you know? And we kind of just laughed about it, went ahead, we cleaned them, processed them up, put them in a Ziploc bag, vacuum sealed them. And I said, I'm going to cook those at some point. I'm going to put them in a stew. So we were at the camp at some point, and we have a can cooker that we cook in religiously. And I don't know if you guys know what the can cooker is, but they advertise a lot of waterfowl hunters and hunter deer camps, duck camps, whatever hunting camps you got. If you don't have a can cooker, guys, you got to get you a can cooker, because can cooker is a phenomenal product that's very easy. And all it is just a old style pressure cooker that has a seal built around the lid. You put whatever contents you want to cook into it all at once, add a little bit of water, a little bit of broth, a little bit of beer to it, whatever you want, and you put the lid on it and you pressure cook it, basically, is what it is. And it tenderizes everything, makes a phenomenal dish, no matter what you cook with it. So anyway, I said, I'm gonna throw these Gallinoo. And I'm gonna defrost these Gallinoo. I told him. I said, we're gonna cook these things tonight, in the can cooker. So that's what we did. We went ahead, we defrosted them, marinated them up. This was like the night before, actually. Marinated them up, put some Cajun seasoning, garlic powder, onion powder, you know, everything that we normally marinate any kind of meat or wild game with. Let them sit in the refrigerator overnight. And we went make our hunts the next day, and we came back. And the great thing about the can cooker is, man, you can have a good meal done within pretty quick time, an hour or two usually. And it's like it's been cooking for day, you know, all day. So pulled those Gallinoo out of the refrigerator that were marinated up, put them in there with some smoked sausage, some onions, some carrots, potatoes. Made a little roux and made a basically a stew is what we made with it. Put the lid on there and let them cook. And when I tell you, we cooked some white rice on the side in the rice cooker. And when I tell you, in about 2 hours, we had the most tender Gallinoo that you could ever cook from that can cooker, pressurizing those hindquarters and those legs on those Gallinoos. It was delicious, guys. It was awesome, man. I mean, it blew me away, to be honest with you. And I don't usually get like wow over wild game. You know, I love wild game, but it's not. I'll take a ribeye most of the time over wild game. You know, I'll just be honest, you know. But this dish was different than anything I had ever cooked wild game wise. And it wasn't comparable to like a duck even, you know. It's just it had its own flavor, its own, had a very, very tame flavor to it. Very good. Almost like if you've ever eaten yard ducks before, like Muscovy ducks or stuff like that. It kind of reminds me of that or like a chicken, you know, a yard chicken that you raise on the farm. If you ever eaten a farm chicken compared to a regular chicken, there's a little bit different texture, a little bit different taste to it. And that's how these Gallinoo work. So I was sold at that point. I was like, man, this is actually really, really good. And smothering it down with all that stuff we put in there and putting it in that can cooker, it was just coming off the bone. So we served us some white rice, scoop us out a little bit of Gallinoo, scoop us out, you know, our vegetables, veggies on top of it with that gravy. And, man, it made a phenomenal dish. When I tell you everybody at the camp wiped it out and there was nothing left, there was nothing left. Well, I was thinking, okay, I'll cook this. We'll have some for the next day. And we wiped everything out. There was nothing left to reheat the next day. So it was a hit. And after that, we started keeping a couple. Each season, we've been keeping a couple. We vacuum seal them. We process them. We vacuum seal them, put them in the freezer. And I've gotten to where I'll put them in a gumbo. If I cook a duck gumbo, I'll throw some Gallinu in there if I got some hindquarters, those legs off those Gallinus. And we got to where a guy showed us where when you process them, you can step on the legs and pull them straight up. And it basically pulls all the meat straight out of the bird and the rest of it that you throw away. Because their breast on a rail on a Gallinu is a lot smaller than a duck breast. It's real, you could breast them, but it's they got a big, big breastbone to them. So it's different than a duck. You're not going to get as much meat off of the breast. We do cut the breast out of them, but we really go for the meat on those leg quarters is what we're looking for. So, and you cook that, like I told you, right there, in a crock pot, a gravy, any kind of thing like that, or put them in a gumbo. It's really good. Gives it a good, rich flavor. It's a very, very good tasting bird species. So yeah, we get those quite a bit at the camp, but now we keep some of those. We don't just target those, but we go and we keep some every season. Now I'll keep them and I'll process them and I vacuum seal them, and then I use them in gumbos and I use them in stuff like that. So really, really good, guys. So don't overlook like your Gallinus. Coots, like I said, coots have a lot of good purposes for their stuff too as well. And I know they're not birds that are up in the hierarchy like we're talking about, but don't overlook them, man. That's really an underrated species that provide excellent table fare if you're looking to kind of expand your culinary dishes, you know, and stuff at the hunt camp maybe. So I promise you, do what I told you right there with like some Gallinu if you have Gallinu in your area. And don't tell anybody at hunt camp what it is and go ahead and cook it like I told you. And it's going to be a hit because they will like it. I guarantee they're going to like it. So that's just a cool story. That's something that like is not high up on the hierarchy when you think about bird species for most hunters. But yeah, I mean, it should be because it's damn good table fare, you know? So, but that question, like I'm talking about, guys, that question I thought was interesting. I had always wondered that. You know, like I knew guys had a hierarchy. Most people that hunt have a hierarchy of what waterfowl species is more important to them. But I wanted to take it to social media, ask them, you know, that same question and see what kind of responses we got. Because it's great conversation, like I talked about. It's great conversation. And it's interesting to see how everybody has different perspectives on that, you know. So I'm glad. Thank you so much for the responses. For those of you who responded to the question, I appreciate it. I found your response is very interesting. So, but switching gears, guys, as we're closing up now, this episode, our first episode of season 7, we want to hope and wish you guys a great look in the rest of your season now, since we have 2 weeks to go and we're going to be wrapping things up, because that's it, man. We are done. And we're going to try to finish out strong, these next 2 weeks, hopefully. And I hope you guys will as well. I know we've had this week, as we record this episode, we have the coldest weather that we've had all year across the United States. Some of the coldest weather we've had all year. So hopefully this, especially down in the South, if you listen and you guys are down in the South, you've been waiting on birds. Hopefully you have some birds that are going to show up, you know, make a last minute push down to you these last couple of weeks, and you can have a little bit of success on some of these hunts. You know, I hear guys talking about older migration with this cold weather. They're going to migrate down to us. And I think we will get a push. My gut feeling is that we will get some birds move in. But for the most part, I think that it's done, guys. It is done with the migration. But, you know, cold weather changes that. So if you have, depending on how much ice we have with this front across the United States, you know, that's gonna play a factor into what we see moving down the flyway. Or what doesn't move down the flyway, you know? So you get a lot of ice cover and everything. That definitely changes the game a lot of times. And it can be an area that didn't have birds today. And that ice moves in, that cold weather pushes them down. And you go tomorrow to that same spot and you have birds or more birds than you've seen all season. It could flip like a light switch. And I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen many, many times. For those of you who have the capability with the way these fronts are going to be hitting, they're hitting during the work week. If you have the capability and ability to hunt during the week, that's a big advantage that you got over all of us who can only hunt on the weekends right now. So take advantage of that, you know, and go out there. Don't, if you're thinking about going, or should I go, should I not go, is it too cold, is it not cold? You know, if you think it's too cold, go. Because I promise you, like I said, that light switch could flip. and those birds could show up overnight in that area that you haven't been having a whole lot of luck in. And that's kind of our situation. The area that we've been hunting the last few weeks, it is pristine, you know, territory for waterfowl. We just haven't had that push of birds get down to us to be able to occupy those areas. So I'm going to be hitting, with this front, these fronts coming through, I'm going to be hitting those areas, continuing to hit those areas I did over the last couple of weeks that I didn't have a lot of success in, because I know that they're areas that traditionally hold waterfowl. It's just we haven't got that big push, you know? But once we get that little push, or big push, hopefully a big push, that comes in, if things get, you know, iced over, then it could change like that. And we could end up having a phenomenal end to the last 2 weeks of the season. So that's what I'm hoping for. That's my wish for the rest of the season. That's my wish for you guys if you're hunting down south right now. And, you know, if you in the upper portions of the flyways, hopefully you guys have been able to maintain some birds, keep some birds to where they're not all pushing out on you, and you can finish up the end of your season strong as well. So that's all I got, guys. That's all I have for this first episode. I thank you, as always, so much for tuning in if you chose to listen to us tonight. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for the support that you guys give us constantly throughout social media, throughout the podcast. And without you guys, we could never do all this, and we would not want to do all this. You guys motivate us. You support us, and you motivate us, and we can never repay you guys enough for what the support that you give to us here at Last Stop Waterfowl Outdoors. So that's all I got, guys. Y'all stay safe out there. Stay courteous of other hunters. Take care of yourselves in these cold conditions. Make sure you have a game plan. You hunt smart from a personal safety standpoint. And go out there and smash them ducks, guys, these last 2 weeks. Let's finish strong. But I wish y'all the best of luck. Stay safe out there. And until next time, this is Jacob with Last Stop Waterfowl Outdoors Podcast, guys. Y'all take care. We'll talk to y'all again soon. Folks, welcome to Game Changer Boats. Don't fall for production boat quality. Many production aluminum bay boats and boats are constructed using 100 gauge in aluminum and are only welded on the outside of the hull, creating weaknesses that promote cracking. The lightness of the construction also increases the roughness of the ride of the boat. Game Changer Boats uses superior materials, thicker aluminum, and better built techniques for your boat. Rest assured knowing that we take pride in the construction of your next boat. If you're in the market for a new boat, visit Game Changer Boats at www.gamechangerboats.net or visit us on Facebook today to place your order. Guys, let's talk fishing for a minute. When you're looking for bait and tackle for all your fishing needs, look no further than Benoit's Performance Baits. Benoit's Performance Baits offer some of the best soft plastics for bass, sacalay, and saltwater species. Rather it's a day on the water or trying to catch a mess of fish for a family fish fry or a heavy bag to win a tournament, Benoit's Performance Baits has what you need and what the fish want. You can visit us on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok to place your order today with Benoit's Performance Baits.